Welcome to Jam Live, the show featuring concerts and events presented by Junction Arts and Music Society in Haines Junction, Yukon. I am Maria Leniak. The Kluane Mountain Bluegrass Festival, going strong since 2003, has brought some of the finest artists of bluegrass music to the Yukon for some early summertime fun. Names like the Abrams Brothers, John Reichman and the Jaybirds, and the Gibson Brothers. Jam Live was there again in 2017 to record more outstanding performances. Jam Live also gets backstage for rewarding interviews with the artists. This time, it's the Boxcars from Tennessee. As in most musical genres, bluegrass is colored by the musicians' personal and professional lives, so we invite you to come along with us as we explore some of the background that underscores the music. And who better than Steve Gedrose, past producer of the Bluegrass Festival, to chat with the Boxcars. Steve met up with Adam Steffi, Keith Garrett, and Gary Haltman during the festival on June 10th, 2017.
Dark clouds hanging over me. When will they go away? Rain is in my eyes and I can't see.
Hello, my name is Steve Gedrose, and we're coming to you from the Kluane Mountain Bluegrass Festival here in downtown Haines Junction, Yukon. I'm here with members of the Boxcars. Welcome, everyone, and thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you for speaking with us, yeah.
Maybe we can just go through. You can introduce yourselves and tell us your role in the band.
Okay. My name's Adam Steffi, and I'm the mandolin player, and I sing lead on some of the tunes and harmony.
Okay.
My name's Gary Haltman. I play the dobro, and I sing a little lead and mostly harmony. So.
And I'm Keith Garrett. I play guitar and sing.
Okay. And maybe you can tell us about the other members.
Yeah, the other two members are Ron Stewart, who plays the banjo primarily, but he also plays the fiddle. So he switches around, you know, depending on the song. And Harold Nixon plays bass.
Right, right. Great. Now, Adam, I'm always interested in band names because it's pretty significant. Like, that's
right.
that's what you're out there known as. How'd you come up with the Boxcars?
Well, we were trying to figure out a name for the group. That's a hard thing.
I know it
is. Trying to figure one out. People, when you put something together and you know you're going to do it and everybody's sitting on go, and we didn't know what to name it. And so we'd come up with a list. We all kind of went home and figured, you know, okay, here's four or five I thought of. And we were speaking with our booking agent at the time.
Okay.
And I personally hadn't thought about this, but he said, well, you need to be sure that the web domain is available. And so, you know, we'd narrowed it down to a few, and I don't even remember what any of the other names were at this point, but the Boxcars was available.
Okay. That was on the list?
That was on the list, and we said, okay, this one's, a couple of them were, you know, I don't even remember what they were, but they were already taken by whatever, you know, like a mortuary or
Whispering Pines or whatever,
something.
Wasn't there the Travelers, something Travelers in there?
Yeah,
we had
something that was in the mix that was like a, anyway, long story short, the domain was taken. So the Boxcars was available, so we went ahead and got the domain for .com, .net, .edu, everything. So that way it was, you know, if anybody accidentally clicked in on one of those, it would send them directly to our site, .com. So that's really the modern technology brought us to the name.
I would have never thought of that.
I wouldn't have either. We just, you know, we were thinking, well, we'll just pick a name and roll with it.
Sure.
But then, you know, there are some groups, I think, that have had issues with that, you know, because somebody may already have the name for, you know, or it's just close enough related to where they can't get that domain for it. So, and, you know, with the way folks navigate the web and want to look at your schedule and want to buy a new product, you know, when you get a new project, it's real important to have that. So we thought, well, we're going to be a brand new band. We've got to get the name out there. Let's make it as easy for people as possible. So, and we weren't, you know, nobody was just absolutely sold on one name and anything. So we were just like, well, we just need to come up with something because our agent had already had some offers, you know, to get us to come and play. He started talking to promoters and this band's coming together. He said, I need a name, guys. I need a name. And then he ran that by me. He said, well, just be sure that the domain's available.
Right.
And so when we started digging, and that's how we ended up landing on the Boxcars.
And it's not like there aren't any train songs in bluegrass, right?
No. So we thought, okay, that'll work.
Oh, that's really interesting. I would have never thought of that. And you didn't want to name it after a particular player, like so-and-so in the...
Right. This is a band, and there's no... Everybody contributes, and we've just always looked at it that way. When we put it together, that's the way we wanted it. It's just like, you know, it wasn't, you know, me and somebody or Ron Stewart and somebody or Keith Garrett and the, you know, whatever. It was, you know, we all contribute and do things. And when you watch our show, it's not just one person singing all the lead.
Exactly.
You know, everybody bounces around, sings lead, and, you know, Ron's switching out on banjo and fiddle. And since the start of the group, the fellow that used to play with us, John Bowman. He would switch between guitar and banjo and fiddle and sing lead. So
right. You've
got a variety of lead singers. Everybody plays. Several play different instruments. You know, they'll switch around, you know, or could.
Sure.
Certainly Keith's a terrific mandolin player.
Sure.
You know, and he played mandolin with Bloomin' Risin', the other bluegrass band from down around home in East Tennessee for years. And I knew him primarily as a mandolin player.
Right.
But also knew he played guitar. So, you know, we never know what will happen in the future where somebody might play a different instrument on a different tune or something.
Of course,
So we just left it open to that.
I read that you and Ron started this discussion at a Starbucks in Wisconsin starting this band. Can you tell us about that?
We did. The way Ron and I first started playing on the road together was as part of the Dan Tominski band.
Okay.
And that was in 2008. And so when we started that with Dan, that was on a hiatus that Dan was taking with Union Station.
Right.
Because Alison Krauss had just did that record with Robert Plant.
Yes.
The Raising Sand album.
Yes.
And so Dan knew he was going to have some time off, and so he asked Ron and I if we would, you know, come out and play that year with him. And it turned into, you know, a couple of years.
Okay.
And we weren't, you know, we thought it'd be over after about a year. Well, as that second year was winding down, this would have been 2009, We were playing one of the last gigs we did, and we were on a trip up to Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and New York, I think, or somewhere, and Vermont. Maybe we played all up, you know, all around the Midwest up into the Northeast, and we were close to the last date. And I'm like, man, it sure would be nice to keep playing. And he said, yeah, man. He said, would you want to maybe put something together? And I said, absolutely. And so we had no idea at that time who or how or what, you know, but that's how it all got started. We were just having coffee across the road from the hotel.
But what I gather is things came together pretty quickly for you.
It did. And it came together better than we could have ever, if we'd sat down and drawn it up. You know? our main thing was Ron and I both have done this for a long time, and we just said, you know, as low maintenance as possible,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we've done this, and, you know, we just wanted people that wanted to do it, and you didn't have to do any babysitting, and you didn't have to, you know, just something that was fun to do that we all came at from the same sort of bluegrass direction. We all have different influences musically.
Of course.
Everywhere.
We'll get into that. I want to talk about that.
So, you know, we all were coming at it from different things as far as what our individual subjective likes and dislikes were, but when it came to bluegrass, everything sort of funneled into one stream, which was, you know, the J.D. Crowell and the New South, Flatten Scruggs, Stanley Brothers,
right.
You know, that kind of thing.
And right.
So when all that, we knew the folks that we were talking to were coming from that same kind of mindset. It came together quick, and we were. I'm thrilled. Tickled the way it's all come together.
And just to have one personnel change since 2009, that's pretty significant in this business, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, I look back and go, man, this is our, this would be what, 8 years?
This would be our seventh year out, right?
Seventh
mm-hmm.
year, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Seventh year, yeah.
It's 2010.
2010.
That's when the first one came out, I think, right?
This would be our eighth year then.
Yeah, right. 2010, we started in January. So basically, like, this is eight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess that's right. I always get screwed up because it's 2010.
Well, I think what I read, you guys were touring before you had your first record.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We toured for a whole, and that was something that we'd started working on the record. You know, we'd cut a few tunes and then cut a few tunes, and then a month or two would go by, and we were out playing already as the Boxcars. But we didn't have an album come out until the end of 2010, around IBMA time of that year, probably September, October.
Right.
I think that's when it was actually released in 2010.
Okay.
So we had toured our agent... at the time was Mike Drudge in Nashville with Class Act Entertainment. Well, Mike he's the one that I was speaking about, about coming up with the band name. And he was really helpful because he had a lot of contacts. And although we didn't have an album, you know, for people to hear, you know, he sold it enough to people and said, you know, these are the guys that are in the band. You'll enjoy it. Let's, you know, take a chance on this. And so we got through that summer and the early fall, you know, just sight unseen, basically.
Right.
So
going on your own individual reputations, though, right? I mean,
yeah. And luckily that. That didn't hurt us.
Well, I'd say, Gary, you really landed on your feet, ended up with these bunch of players.
Yeah, I'm really, really fortunate and blessed. I consider myself to be able to play with them. They're all my heroes, so it's really cool.
It's pretty interesting to me that you're the only Yankee in the bunch, too.
Yeah, right? Yeah, they deal with me nonetheless, but yeah, I'm adapting slowly. Every year I become a little more mountain, I guess.
That's good. That's a good thing. And I see that you're associated with Mountain Home Music. We've been blessed to host the Balsam Range, the Grascals, and Flat Lonesome, and they all couldn't say enough about dealing with this company. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they're as I was talking about with as far as the band, we wanted something that was low maintenance, but you could depend on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they're totally supportive of any idea that we've got. They don't, you know, there's no handcuffs on you to, okay, we have to have a new product every, you know, 8 months.
I see.
Or we have, within a certain amount of time, you have to have this. And when we first started recording, we were looking at different labels, and we had some interest from different labels. And it was John Bowman that brought up, you know, we ought to talk to these guys and see what we could work out. And it's been great. You know, they're just everybody's, you know, pro what we want. If we don't want to do something, they're good with that too. They're
right.
Like, you guys know where you want this to go, and you guys do it, and we'll support it. And
that's excellent.
You just don't find that
in
any label.
Of course.
And especially, you know, in bluegrass, since there's such, you know, it seems to be getting smaller every year, you know, with the technology that's out there, you know, labels are disappearing, you know, and
that's
especially
true.
Or they're having to combine and congeal with something else.
So right.
For those guys to be as supportive and loose with us as they are, we really appreciate them.
Great. Let me see here. Let's get Keith in here. Maybe you can tell us how songs come into the band. A lot of you guys are writing songs, I gather.
Yeah, I've written some of the songs that we do, and Ron has written a few songs that we've recorded and that we perform. It's really just a collective effort, you know, as far as trying to get material, and we're kind of in that process now, trying to hope to round up some songs for a new project, but it's mainly just, you know, if you get a few ideas to throw in the mix, and then everybody listens to the songs, and then we kind of see, you know, if it makes it past the point of where we were actually going to sit down and try to start working it up, try to arrange it.
Okay, I was just going to ask about that. So the arrangements kind of evolve organically amongst the band?
Yeah, in the studio, and you know, Adam is really great at arrangements, and Adam and Ron, and, you know, but then primarily we're just kind of sitting there working on them together before we record them.
Great.
And that's been, I think, the way we've done almost everything,
yeah,
except for maybe those first few where we did actually, I guess, rehearse them and play them some before we recorded them. Well, I don't know. I guess we did record them.
Yeah. Well, I remember the first things we recorded we had to do, we were trying to get on, this was in January or something, 2010, and we were trying to get there was a deadline that we had to meet to get considered for a showcase slot at the International Bluegrass Music Association convention, which wasn't going to be in 2010 until 10 months later.
It's in the fall, isn't it?
But there's a cutoff on like what you can submit to be considered.
Of course.
And so we were trying to hit that deadline. And so those first three songs, I think we'd played like one date,
mm-hmm,
somewhere, maybe a radio show,
mm-hmm,
maybe a couple things. But we had to have it in by then. So we didn't have the luxury of, like what we do now, of having dates that we can try songs out.
I was just going to ask about that.
Maybe change, you know, the arrangement on it. If it's working on stage, if it's not.
Right.
You know, when we're working up a new song. But primarily our rehearsal, people ask, you know, how often do you guys rehearse? And it's primarily when we're in the studio.
Right.
And then when we do them on stage, that's how it just sort of turns into what it is. But, yeah, everything we've done is kind of like exactly what Keith said. This newest record, the Familiar with the Ground album,
mm-hmm,
that we have out now,
mm-hmm,
that's the way we worked it up, was just to got in the studio. We knew we had a list of songs, and we were like, we like this one. Maybe hold on that one for another time. and it just sort of came together.
Great.
And the arrangements fall together, and everybody contributes to it. And it's not just one person saying, okay, you play this now, you play this. It's like we sort of get an arrangement in mind, okay, the dobro will kick this off.
Okay.
And then we'll play through it and see, okay, what do you think if a guitar took the first break as opposed to, you know, okay, let's have a banjo right here.
Okay.
Know, or something. So it just sort of goes like that.
Sure.
And who's going to sing harmony on what? You'll know primarily, you'll have the layout, okay, this person will sing lead on it. But as to how you're going to stack harmony and how you're going to, you know, if it's going to be three-part, two-part, things like that, it just seems to fall together.
Great, great. I think it's pretty rare to have five singers in a five-piece band, don't you?
Yeah, it is.
And it really adds incredible variety to your sets.
Well, and everybody's different, too. So
right, exactly.
It does give that variety as far as the sound.
I was looking at All Music Guide just to get a listing of who had written each songs, and they had as your themes for your music, country life, reminiscing, and heartache. Does that kind of sum it up?
Well, the heartache especially.
For sure. And death.
I thought that was a funny combination of things, but when I heard you last night, sure
enough, reminds me of that.
Elements of those things were all there.
We're dark.
I think it was the Earl Brothers had a record. It was called Whiskey, Women, and Death.
Yes. We need a T-shirt with that on it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
We tend to gravitate toward, you know, darker songs. They're not real happy-go-lucky sounding songs. I mean, so, you know, some of them are, but...
Well, that kind of leads me to my next question. Maybe you guys could talk about your own musical influences and who your heroes are and who you listen to coming up.
Well, for me, I know personally, all the guys in the band really are huge influences on me. I when I first started playing music, it was kind of it was a weird way to get into bluegrass, I guess. There was a guy traveling around giving lessons out of his motorhome back home in Minnesota. And kind of through the rest of the family starting like, well, let's start taking some lessons on, you know, banjo or guitar or whatever and, you know, what have you. We got into bluegrass that way. And I was younger, you know, and I'd never really listened to bluegrass very much.
Sure.
And so I got into bluegrass through, say, bands like Nickel Creek and things like that, kind of on the more outside edge of it, I guess. Or
yeah, they're approaching pop, I'd say.
Yeah. And the more I played it and the more, you know, I got to be, especially once I moved to ETSU to go to school to Johnson City, I mean, I got really more exposed to the traditional stuff and I learned to really appreciate it. And then, you know, of course, Flat and Scruggs and, you know, all those guys, Bluegrass Album Band have become huge influences of mine and everything, you know, that Adam and Keith and them have all played on is just, it's some of my favorite stuff, so.
And I saw Rob Ikes in the mix.
Yeah, Rob's he's such a huge influence on me. He's such a great guy, and I love what he plays. And Jerry Douglas, of course, as well. You know, he's like the dobro hero.
Of course.
Dobro player guy, I guess.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
But
how about you, Adam?
Well, I got into playing. I got interested in acoustic music and really just old time and bluegrass because the first place I was exposed to it was at a place called the Carter Fold, which is the Carter family home place.
Okay.
And they have it's kind of a dance kind of music every Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And they've had it since the 70s. And so my grandfather, his name was Fred Carter. He's passed away now. But he grew up there, and I'm actually, my middle name is Carter, and I'm related to the Carter family through cousinship somehow. But anyway, the AP, Sarah, and Maybell Carter home place is there, and so their children have kept it up and kept it going. So they have music there every Saturday night and still do, and we play up there occasionally. It's great, but it's just, you know, they just want to clog and flat foot dance, you know, and stuff. And
sure.
A lot of fiddle tunes, but that's the way it was back then as well, but... I'd been going up there with him. He would go just to talk to friends and family that he grew up with mm-hmm. up there in the valley. They call it Poor Valley. And so he would go up there to hang out and visit. And he was just up there to, you know, kind of talk and visit. But I'd started paying attention to the music, you know. And I just wanted to go to hang out with him. But I started paying attention to the music. And so I got into it through that.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you know, I was listening to, I had a, like, I remember I had this full-size, it's huge, it's just full-size wall poster, you know, it's like this wide and this tall of Kiss.
Okay. I wouldn't have guessed that.
And I had just bought the, it's called One More From the Road, and it was a Lynyrd Skynyrd double up live album. You know? And so I was right on that verge of wanting to get like, you know, I want to be Southern rock.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to make a chord.
You weren't playing.
No, I wasn't playing nothing else.
Okay.
But I saw this group at the Carter Folk called the Lost and Found.
Okay.
And a guy named Dempsey Young, who's passed away a few years ago. But when I saw something about the way he played the mandolin, it was just like, zing, you know, it's something out of a cartoon or something, you know. And so I was like, man, what is that? I like that. And I'd seen it before. There have been plenty of bands come through there with a mandolin. But for some reason, when I saw him play, I was like, yes, I really want to learn that.
Excellent.
You know? And so that's got me started. And then I got to getting into everything, you know. And so the Kiss poster came down off the wall. I was putting records on the wall, you know, anything. At that time, that was right when Doyle Lawson had started his first configuration of Quicksilver.
Okay.
And so I was just getting into the mandolin heavy, and all these folks that I was starting to meet, they were saying, well, you need to listen to some Doyle, because Doyle's originally from Kingsport, where I was at the time. You know, I live close by there now.
Okay.
But they said, you need to listen to some Doyle Lawson. So I got him, and sort of came back around to Bill Monroe.
Stanley, I see, Brothers, later. Okay.
So I've got into Doyle Lawson and then Sam Bush, and then I started listening to David Grisman.
Yes.
And then, you know, I started noticing, you know, I was learning these tunes, and I'd go to jams and nobody knew these tunes, you know. It's like everybody's playing these old tunes. And so I said, well, I need to learn some of those if I'm going to be able to get in these jams and pick some.
Sure.
So then I started realizing, oh, that's why everybody talks about Bill Monroe and the Stanley Brothers and Reno and Smiley and, you know, Flatt & Scruggs and all that kind of stuff. So then I started getting all those records.
Okay.
And trying to, you know, consume as much of that as I could.
Well, that really is a source.
Yeah. And so I always tell people, wherever you're at, you know, definitely listen to that stuff too. You know, you can listen to all the newer stuff and it's awesome, and there's a lot of bands out there that are doing really cool different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with this configuration of instruments,
yes,
whether it be Punch Brothers or,
of course,
you know, the String Dusters or anybody like that. There's so many, you know, good groups out there that are way beyond my thought process, you know, but it's fun to see it. And once I got latched onto that, it's like I've never really wanted to veer off and go any too far off the road for that. So that brings me up to the Boxcars.
Right. How about you, Keith?
Well, I've always remember, ever since I can remember, my earliest memories of music, my dad played guitar and played bluegrass, and that's all he listened to was bluegrass. So I remember even as a kid, and even when I don't recall liking it very much, listening to Stanley Brothers, Bill Monroe, and Country Gentlemen, and all kinds of early stuff. And then I started playing when I was 13, and of course he taught me how to play. And then I guess it wasn't until I was excited about playing just because I was learning stuff, but I think about 6-8 months into me playing, Dad had this record, the J.D. Crow record, that Rounder 44 record that had Tony Rice playing on it.
Okay.
And that was the first time I'd heard him. And then I just, became enthralled with everything that he ever did, singing and playing and everything. And so I guess he was probably my biggest influence as far as, you know, getting me into bluegrass, listening to the music of Tony Rice.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's kind of like what Adam was saying, that, you know, leads you down the path of, like, then you hear Ricky Skaggs, and then you kind of go backwards and hear the influences that Bill Monroe had on, you know, them and the Stanley Brothers and Flatt & Scruggs and all that kind of stuff. But outside of that, I mean, I think after I started playing, too, I really liked some of the country music of the time.
Okay.
You know, like older country music. Up until about probably mid-90s, I guess, you know, any country music before about that time.
I've had a few people tell me they lament that country music died.
Well, it certainly changed a whole lot.
Yeah. But so is this just a function of where you guys live, that bluegrass was really high on the list of things you're interested in?
It could be. I mean, it does seem to, you know, of course, we're surprised, you know, going different places where bluegrass, and there's little hotbeds of bluegrass, and, you know, other places outside of the South. But I think it's probably, especially since some of those early groups like Flatt & Scruggs and Stanley Brothers are kind of rooted in the South and Southern traditions, and so that might be one reason why it's so easy to kind of veer that way.
Yeah, I just find with a lot of people I've talked to about this that their family was involved in music. Is that the case? That's the case for you, or
just the interest in it at least?
Yeah. But playing too?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And, well, I guess primarily him. Well, His brothers also played, and so it was kind of a family. I remember going to family reunions and playing some when I first started, and playing a lot in church when I was a kid as well.
Okay.
Along with Dad and Mom at times. We'd had a little trio where we'd go around and play and sing in church.
Great.
So I think it's, for me it was a combination of that, the geographical location and the family kind of connection to it.
Right. Right.
I always just took it for granted, until I started playing out regionally and around,
Okay.
That this is everywhere, people play all over the place. And then I talked to someone like Gary, who's from northern Minnesota originally.
And it's that like, was not the case.
It's a pretty scattered scene in Minnesota.
Of course, but there is a scene.
Yeah, yeah, and there's some really good festivals up there. And I grew up playing with my family. We had a little family band, and that's what we'd, once we got into it, that's what we'd start doing. We'd go to the festivals every year, and we look forward to that for like, as soon as that one ended, we're like, all right, only, however, a year until we get to go again. So,
okay, I see.
But, yeah.
Well, it's really, we touched on this a bit, but bluegrass continues to be pretty popular these days. I think, is that just a craving for acoustic music, or is it the themes of the songs, or what do you guys, what's your take on that?
Well, I've thought about it a lot over the years, and it seems to me like it bluegrass will ebb and flow. It's like it'll ride a wave up, for a bit. Like you can look back over it. The most recent real tidal wave was the Oh Brother.
Of course, where art thou, yes.
And I'm sure that when they were doing that, there was no idea that it would have that. Like the soundtrack of that movie actually became as popular or more so than had greater success than the movie even, I'm sure, but
isn't that interesting,
but that brought bluegrass to a whole other thing.
Sure.
And every now and then you'll have something that's right on the cusp that people will consider bluegrass, say a wagon wheel song.
Okay.
Or something like that.
Right.
And people will go, oh, I love bluegrass, and so, but then it'll settle back down, and then it'll ride another wave, and you can look back like the Beverly Hillbillies,
right, of course,
that brought it in there, and then it faded out a little bit, and then it came back up with, say, the Bonnie and Clyde movie.
Of course.
And so, it seems to have these little, it rides these kind of ways, but there's always this almost a constant kind of thing, and people worry about, I don't worry about the history, not the history, but the future of bluegrass.
Of course.
I don't worry about it, because everywhere we go, we see kids. I mean, I didn't start playing until I was 14, 15,
okay.
So I'm an old, I was geriatric by the time, by today's standards, because you go to IBMA and you see these kids now, and they'll be 7, 8 years old, and I'm not blaming it on technology, but with the access that you have to learning.
Exactly.
Now, I mean, you can learn stuff and look stuff up and contact people,
of course.
Via social media. You can contact a player that... I remember sitting with record players, and I tell students at school now, it's like sitting with a record player. You didn't slow stuff down and all that. It was like you just had to sit and listen to it a million times. So you developed your ear and things like that. But I don't worry about bluegrass. I feel like it's any popularity that it has now, it can only go up. It can settle back down. But I feel like it's got this base that where it's always going to be kind of a, I would be surprised if it ever became a mainstream pop kind of, I don't feel like you're going to see your Ariana Grandes and your, Jennifer Lopez.
Right.
That kind of success.
Success.
You're not going to
monetary
have,
success.
I don't feel like you're going to have a Prince in
right.
Bluegrass.
Right. Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay. Yeah.
Or something
I do.
Like that. So I feel like it's always going to be, somebody called it a boutique music one time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's sort of, it's its thing.
Okay.
It is what it is. It's
yeah.
a specialty kind of thing. I don't expect everybody to like it.
Right.
And I would be lying to you if I said I like everything in bluegrass, every band, everything.
Sure.
I have my preferences of bands that I like and those that I don't. Just like if you list, back when I was listening to Kiss
yeah.
and Lynyrd Skynyrd, I didn't want to hear Queen. I didn't want to hear this stuff. And now I can listen to it and go, wow, that stuff is amazing, but I don't want to hear Led Zeppelin. I had my choices,
Okay.
So, but it's that way with bluegrass. It's that way, I think everybody's that way. There's probably opera snobs and,
No doubt.
There's classical snobs.
Of
and
course.
So, but I feel with bluegrass, it's such a specialty thing, and some people are never, I think, going to get past the fact that they'll look at it like it's some kind of a hokum sort of, people chewing on straw and wearing overalls and stuff like that. And it's
I think, like the bands, like you mentioned, the Punch Brothers, Gary earlier, the bands like the Punch Brothers, and even bands are not really bluegrass, but I guess Americana, or there's going to be a banjo in the mix, like Mumford and Sons.
Of course, yes.
And Avett Brothers and stuff like
okay.
that. They have done one thing, which I think they take away some of that sentiment that Adam's talking about. Some people don't think of it as hokey music as much anymore, mm-hmm. just because if you see a big band on a big stage and they've got a banjo, it kind of makes it seem like it's cooler, you know.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So I've noticed that more now. You know, like Adam said, not everybody's not going to like bluegrass, especially traditional bluegrass, but they seem to accept it a little bit more as a legitimate form of music versus mm-hmm. maybe when I was a kid. It seemed like when I was a kid, it was much more like the stereotype he was talking about earlier about it just being sort of a hick kind of music.
I think there's something to be said for the live aspect of it, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. It's such an improvisational music, I think. And when I had started playing with my family and stuff, we were the only people in the area that really played bluegrass. So.
Right.
All my friends were like, "What's bluegrass? I don't like it." You know, blah blah blah.
And then they even know what it is.
Exactly. And if I'd take them to the festival with me or something, and they got to see it live, they're like, "Oh wow, I really like this." You know, there's something about that, I guess, seeing it where people are making the music themselves with acoustic instruments, and it's not.
I think it's. I think that the sort of the straight line that I was talking about kind of it's always replenishing itself, because I feel like as young people get older, and they start having kids of their own, and it's not grunge metal or whatever, and they grow out of that, and it's kind of like, okay, that was my phase I was going through or whatever. And they may still enjoy listening to the old recordings and things like that. Like, I love to hear Lynyrd Skynyrd to this day,
know,
but it's like, after a while, your tastes change
and
everything as you get older.
Of course.
And so, as they get older and they start having kids, then they're looking for something that's a little more real, I think. It's not so much pop and drama and smoke and all that kind of stuff. And so there's always going to be a turnover of people that are sort of getting into it. And it seems like when people get into it, bluegrass is one of the only kinds of music that you can get into and play where your crowd is going to follow you from when you're 20-something, you're a 20-something like Gary, and if Gary plays until he's whatever, people that he meets here will remember Gary, 30 years from now.
That's interesting.
And I know that for a fact, because I've been doing this for 30-some-odd years, playing around regionally, nationally, around, doing cool stuff like this in different parts of the world.
Yes.
And so, those people see you, and I see people to this day at different festivals that we play around, in the States that I've seen. Well, we were out in California back in January, February of this year. And there are people that have come out to those shows that I've seen since I was, since 1990, 89,
kidding.
Stuff like that. They're like, "Yeah, I first saw you when you were playing with this or that band."
Wow.
And so once they get into it, it seems like they're in it. And they keep coming to shows, and you can play until you're, there are people in their 70s and 80s that are still out playing.
Absolutely.
And you just don't see that very often with, your really wildly popular stuff, unless they're just superstars like a James Taylor or a Michael Jackson.
Okay, but he's expanding what he's doing, too.
Sure.
He's not sticking with the same old song.
And so, you get people like that, and it seems like there's few and far between in really popular kinds of music that have that kind of staying power. But it seems like in categories like jazz
mm-hmm.
or bluegrass
mm-hmm.
and things like that are more, improvisational kind of things. It's not so produced, that it's like there's, 500 tracks of music to do one 3-minute song.
Right. Right.
It's like bluegrass. It's pretty much when you come see it, it's just like what we're doing here.
Right.
You play, you get it warts and all,
It's right.
like you just play and go.
Right.
And it's not a big production. There's nothing really going on. And it's if you foul up, you foul up and grin and keep going.
Right.
There's no way of covering your tracks with it. There's not
like
a lot
a live
of
performance.
Not a lot
sure.
of sound effects and stuff going on. It's
right.
you just dive in and hang on.
Well, I think it's exactly what you guys are talking about. It's just the sincerity of the people doing this kind of music
mm-hmm.
that
and
keeps
the fans,
driving it.
And the fans, too, are sincere about it, because they love it and they're supportive. And when they find an artist, or, and it doesn't have to be a band, and per se. Like if the boxcars for some reason cease to exist, which I hope it doesn't, but you know, if the boxcars cease to exist 2 or 3 years from now, each individual in this band are still going to be, you know, those people that saw us as this group are going to continue to support wherever you're at.
Yeah.
They're like, boy, I hated to see, you know, you hear that all the time. It's like, well, I hated to see that you leave this band, or I hate, you know, whatever, but they still come see you.
Great.
Any
Great.
New configuration you put together. So it's unique music that way. The fans are unique, I think, that get into it because they're real loyal.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are, you know, when you're dealing with who buys the most albums, I think I saw a thing where, is it girls from the age of 12 to 21 are the highest market?
Or maybe even younger.
Something like that. They consume the most, like, music as far as pay for the music. And so you're not, I mean.
Like that, Ariana Grande, you were talking about. Yeah, that's her constituency, right?
And that stuff is going to change.
Yeah.
You know,
it's sure, as they mature.
So,
And
in bluegrass, it seems like folks are a little older. I'm not going to say more mature, but, you know.
Not necessarily, but,
you know, they're a little more seasoned, let's say. And so they start realizing people they like, and the artists in this music are really accessible.
Yeah, that's a huge thing.
Whereas, you know, all the other stuff, there's like this invisible, sometimes it's a very literal iron curtain, you know, that you'll never get close to an artist.
Exactly.
And so in this kind of music, I think people, that's one of the things that I think surprises people, like what Gary said, when you come to a show, it's like you could go see a J.D. Crow in the New South, and you can walk right up to J.D. and say, hey, man, I really enjoy your playing, and shake his hand. And that's, looking back on it, that's something that I didn't realize at the time, but that's really cool.
You know, is it ever?
You can go up to somebody, you know, any of the artists here, you know, they're walking around town, and you can go ask them, sign something, sit down, talk with them for a minute, you know.
And that seems to me that's the history of this music. That's probably always been.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I hope it always is that way.
Me too. Well, maybe you can tell me about some young bands that you're excited about. Are there people on the scene that you're thinking are going in an interesting direction?
There's several bands that there's a group that I feel like is the most underrated band out there right now. It's called Volume 5.
Okay. I agree with that. Yeah.
Okay. I've listened to a bit of theirs.
And they're not a new band by any means.
Right.
They've been around a few years, but man, they are making some really good music. And there's a group of young, well, I won't call them kids because they're not kids. They're teenagers. But there's a group called Clay Bank. They're from back home. But they're young players, and who knows how long that band will be together. But I see young pickers like that are, you know, that are after it and hungry and really enjoying it, you know. There's a host of young bands out there, but I think more in terms of like the individual players that I've seen get into it as kids. And I can remember when they first started playing and, you know, watch them put a band together or see a youngster, you know, grow into a young adult and then they're out playing with someone.
Right.
Like a good friend of mine, Jason Burleson, that plays with the group Blue Highway.
Okay.
His son, Jacob Burleson, who now plays with Volume 5.
Okay.
I'm trying to tie all this together.
Yeah.
I remember Jacob when he first started playing.
Right.
And now he's a monster. I remember him playing the mandolin, but now he plays banjo, guitar. He's, what, 18? Just graduated high school?
Yeah, just graduated.
And, I mean,
he's amazing.
He's unreal.
He had a pretty good mentor at home.
Yeah. Right. And so I remember Jason, you know, he never forced it on him, but he got interested in it and just let him develop and steered him. And, you know, I take a lot of interest in that, more so than, like, here's a hot young band or here's this and that, because I've you know, there's a lot of changeover in this music and a lot of people, especially with young folks, because if they don't have families yet and they haven't been traveling a long time, you know, it's a different life.
Yes.
You know, and I just sort of fell into it and then looked back and said, wow, this is kind of what I've been doing for all these years, but never expected to do it, you know.
Right.
And so
that's interesting.
That's
just
sort of how it all came together and the way the Lord wanted it to work.
Yeah.
But yeah, I see young players. There's a oh gosh, I'm trying to think of his name now. Young mandolin player I met at IBMA a couple years ago, and I'm terrible with names. I see faces more than names. I'm terrible with people's names. But
we had Jeff Scroggins' son here last year. He's a pretty fair picker that long.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And we've met people. What was the name of the band? It was Chris Luquette, who plays now with Frank Sullivan.
Okay.
Guitar player with
yes,
Frank Sullivan.
Yes, okay.
Some acoustic circus, is that right?
Knows Devon.
We played a festival. It was early on as
Northern
the Boxcars.
Northern?
Northern, not Northern Lights. Northern Departure or something. Northern,
yeah.
Northern Territory, maybe. Okay. Anyway, we played a festival over here. We ran into them whenever we were in the Northwest.
Okay.
Like Washington State or maybe Oregon. And Chris Luquette was playing guitar. He was, you know, maybe 19, 20 at that
right.
time, maybe. And so now he's playing with Frank Sullivan.
Right.
And Nick Dumas, who's a mandolin player, who, you know, great musician, singer. He's now playing with Special Consensus,
okay.
you know. And so I see these youngsters, you know, it's like these natural steps that they take. Well, another one is Stephen Burwell.
Okay.
He lives in the same town I do, and somebody nicknamed him Bird.
Okay.
He's calling Bird. And so I almost called him that. But Stephen Burwell was around that same crew, you know, at that time in Seattle and Washington, Oregon area. And so now he's Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver's fiddle player,
okay.
has been for several years. So I see young guys all over the country, you know, that end up getting into it one way or the other.
But this is learning by doing
yeah.
rather than going
right.
to school?
Exactly.
Okay.
It's a lot of that. And a lot of people, you know, East Tennessee State University there in Johnson City, I'm on the faculty there, and they have a program. That's how I first met Gary.
Yes.
That's how I first
yeah.
met
yes.
Gary. And so when John told us he was going to leave and start doing his ministry work full time, we didn't know what we were going to do.
Of course.
And so we got together with Gary, and he had actually sat in with us, you know, and jammed on a tune or two before, and we said, well, you know, what about a dobro? You know, Keith actually mentioned it. He said, man, because we were thinking fiddle, you know.
Sure.
Who do we know that plays fiddle? And I remember Keith said, man, what would a dobro be like? You know?
Yeah.
And so it's like, well.
We played with Gary. He just sat in on a couple tunes with us at a show up in,
yeah.
in Galax, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, Adam was nice enough to let me ride with him up to their show, you know, and watch him. You
okay.
know? And I was playing with the school band at the time. He's like,
okay.
well, man, I'll pick you up. Bring your axe. You know, you might get to play one or something. I was like, oh, you know, freaking out. And,
but you did.
Yeah, yeah, and they were kind enough to get me up there and play. And, it, you know, I was like, oh, man, I can die now. You know, that was awesome. And then, you know, Adam talked to me a little while later after that about playing with the band, and he was like, yeah, don't tell anybody. And I was like, I walked out of there grinning like ear to ear.
Of course.
I had to tell all my friends.
Of course.
There's no way. There's
no
you're
way. Not
gonna... They're like, what are you smiling about? I'm like, I can't tell you.
I can't tell you. Or I'd have to kill you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
See, John had just told us he was going to leave, and we had sat down and talked about it, the four of us, Keith and I and Ron and Harold, and we're like, well, do you guys, what do you think, you know, do you want to go just a fiddle player? Do you want to try and find a multi-instrumentalist like John was? Do you want to, how do we approach it? And what do you think about a dobro? And, you know, we mentioned Gary, and I said, well, let's get together. And so we got together about a month later or something like that.
Right.
And John was kind enough to tell us, you know, he said, no, I'll play out the rest of the year if you want me to. And he told us probably in May or something like that.
Something like
he
that.
Said, I'll stay as long as you guys need me. He said, I'm not going to leave you high and dry. So that was cool. So we didn't feel rushed at all.
Right.
But
make
I mean,
right
as soon as we sat down with Gary, you know, it was like, man, that's going to give us a different sound. And it wasn't like we're trying to replace John with another John or something, which would be
because
hard.
You can't.
It'd be hard to do.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't be able to.
Yeah.
And so it was like, it, you know, that way it made it sort of, it just added to the sound a different color kind
uh-huh.
of thing, as opposed to, okay, here's a new John, you know, or here's somebody that's trying to mimic what we were doing, you know.
Right.
It took it a whole different way.
Right.
And so it's cool. It was really cool. And to have somebody like Gary, as I said from the start, you know, we try to keep everything as bare bones and not loose-knit, but we want it to be a cohesive, you know, tight sound. But as far as the business end of it and the travel and everything, you know, I told Gary, I said, man, this is going to be the most laid-back operation you've ever been a part of or will be a
yeah,
part
really,
of.
I'm really fortunate to be starting out. Like, this is my first, you know, professional kind of gig,
sure.
so to say. And it's, you know, I couldn't have dreamed of something, you know, more easygoing or better or musically, you know, creatively satisfying, I guess, because they played my favorite music and I'd wore it out. Adam probably doesn't remember. It's funny. When I first came down and visited ETSU, I was getting the tour around the, you know, the bluegrass area or whatever the program, the classrooms and stuff. And And they took me down there into the practice rooms, and they're like, "Oh yeah, Adam Steffi's right down here. He's probably teaching a lesson." And I was like, "Oh," and then they opened the door, and the director Dan introduced me to Adam, and Adam was like, "Yeah, hopefully we get to play in a band together one day."
and it came.
He was talking about school, you know, because sure. Adam directs bands and stuff at school and right. all that. But
we did that too.
We did that as well. Yeah, but it was just kind of funny us.
I'm interested in that program. How long has this program been going?
Since the 84.
Oh, you're kidding.
Maybe. A fellow named Jack Tottle started it, and it started out just with a handful of members.
Okay.
And I was in one of the early configurations. I came in I'd started college at a different school nearby, and then I transferred when I heard that Jack was over there doing that, because you could actually get, it was only like 3 hours credit or something.
Still.
But he was teaching like a history class, and he had a band class, you know. And
right.
It was really, really loose, because he had just started it and became aware of it, but people were starting to get into it. But since that time, this was 85, and since then it's become it started out just growing a little bit, growing, and Jack retired, and Raymond McLean took it over.
Okay.
And so Raymond took it over, and they kept developing, and kept more and more people started getting into it. And now it's fully accredited. You can get your degree in history, not history, but bluegrass,
Old time studies.
Okay.
It's under they have a department there on campus. It's called the Appalachian Studies Department.
Okay.
And so through that, you can study everything, you know, about the Appalachians, you know. But
yeah.
this concentration is the musical side of it. And so you can take, when you get into it, you know, you can take lessons in Celtic fiddle. You can take, you know, you can do a full-blown country band. You can do bluegrass. You can do old time.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn about the different things. And so it's grown and grown now to where it's they've only had the full degree program for, I think, the last 5 years.
Okay.
So Gary was one of the you know.
Yeah, I think it was Brent Burke, who plays dobro with Rhonda Vincent. He was like one of the very first ones.
Okay,
And there's been, I think there were, this just last month, I think Dan, the director, told me that I think they graduated 16.
Yeah, there's a bunch.
Maybe 16 or 19.
Right.
And so as I understand it, we had a faculty meeting, and in the fall there's going to be like 38 freshmen coming in.
So this is drawing people to the area? These are not local people necessarily.
Well, that's how I heard about ETSU. Was my buddy, Gavin Largent, who plays dobro with Blue Highway.
Okay.
I'd met him at a camp years ago. And he was like, "Yeah, you should. I heard about ETSU. They have a bluegrass program. You could go to bluegrass school." And I'm like, "What? No way!" And that
was right up your street.
That's what I ended up doing. Yeah, and I went and visited the school and was like, "Wow, this is amazing." So,
and a lot of people are in that program. They take part in the program, but they're majoring in other things. You can get a minor in bluegrass.
I see.
So there's a lot of the people that are graduating. You know, they'll be well. There's a good. Good buddy of mine, a student that just graduated, that he was actually a business. Mitch was an economics major, wasn't he?
He double majored, I think, in
Masons. Masons was like a finance or business management or something,
He's going back to school.
For his master's. So, and there's a boy that graduated, Kyle Murphy, who he's fixing to. He graduated with his math degree.
Okay.
A great mandolin player. He's from California.
Okay.
But he ended up in East Tennessee
to this program.
Yeah. But he majored in math, and he just got his master's in mathematics, and he's fixing to go do his PhD work in Iowa at a university.
I see.
So, I mean, there's all these people from various things, but the program is kind of what draws them in there, because you don't have to major in it if you come there, but you can still be a part of the program.
Right.
You know, and so.
But you have to play at a particular level, right? Or not?
Well, you can come in, and they take everybody from absolute beginners to advanced.
I see.
A lot of the people that come in may have been playing for a couple of years, but they've never really played a lot in a group or the band, and so they try to fit people in bands, you know, and so it's fun to watch all that happen, like I said before, to see people that are kind of shy and kind of, you know, closed in, and then they get around other people that are at their same level of playing. Because a lot of times, I remember when I first started, it's intimidating when you just know three or four chords and you go and you're wanting to play so bad that you feel like, man, I'm just dragging all this down. But to get around other people, you know, that are sort of at your same skill set and to watch all of them kind of move on, you know.
Right.
And the ones that are hungry for, not all of them are, not all of them do. Thought I may just be looking for what they want to major in, you know, for that first year. So.
Sure.
But to see them get, you know, okay, this is what I want to do, or maybe this isn't for me, but I'll major in this and still play.
How exciting!
And so it's right. Neat to watch that.
Great. I guess, Keith, I'll come back to you. Are there any young bands that you're looking at that you, or is it more individual players? Or,
well, if, I was going to say the same thing about Volume 5, and like Adam said, they're not necessarily a young band. There's a couple young pickers in it. I would probably have to agree that seeing young people like Gary and all these ETSU guys just have just such a big interest in the music and seeing them go back and doing the same things that we did, you know, finding older music and kind of coming full circle with it, I think that's what's exciting to me, is to see people do that.
Right.
And
right.
That gives you confidence that it is something that is, you know, it's legitimate, it's going to keep going, you know, as it has been for decades. So I'm trying to think of any other bands besides the ones you mentioned. Like you know more of the younger bands, Gary.
Oh gosh, well I know more of the, you know, I have a I know more of the, like Adam was saying, the individuals. You know, Bird is a good buddy of mine, and you know all those guys. I get to know them, and they you know end up playing with different bands and stuff. And fortunate for that, you know, to. But I mean, bluegrass is that way, I guess, in general. You know, you see all these folks. It's such a small community, I guess. You get to see everybody all the time, and it's cool to see friends out there playing and stuff.
And
see them on
succeeding.
The road. Yeah,
yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it's fun. But
there's a lot of changeover, and a lot of bands will shift around and move around. But it's very rare that a feud goes on for long. Like if someone feels like someone stole one of their band members, you know, or something like that. That doesn't last.
Okay.
Know, because you see each other all the time, and it's like, you know, let's just play music and go about what we do, you know. So I'm sure there's some deep scars on some people out there, but that's just the nature of this business.
Of course.
I figured out a long time ago, you got to let stuff like that just roll off, you know. And if there's a band change or someone leaves or whatever, don't take it personally. It's business, and it's no different than any other business. You know,
right.
When you're doing this as a profession, well, I'd say that loosely because I feel like I'm a professional, but you know,
you don't.
No, I don't.
Are you serious?
It is. It's when I have to pay my bills. Yeah, but other than that, like when I'm here, I mean, for Pete's sake, I'm looking out the window. At, you know, I'm looking at this awesome view, and I'm thinking, this is what. No, but you know, I'm just feel really blessed, and everything's happened exactly like it's supposed to happen. And, you know, if I don't play another note tomorrow, I've gone way, 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 way beyond anything I ever thought to start with.
Places so, you've been able to visit.
Oh, yeah. Places I've been. Just to play a mandolin.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Playing a mandolin. That's, I think it's crazy, you know, when I see sports people get paid gazillions of dollars and they whine, you know. It's like you're playing ball, sweetheart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're swinging a bat.
You know, so
yes.
We had the opportunity this morning. Rick Nelson.
Oh, yes.
Up in his plane.
Okay.
And, so Gary, myself, and Ron, and Harold. And Harold's our bass player, is really into like aviation and stuff
okay.
like that. And Harold made that remark when we got off the plane, talking about just, you know, it just kind of hit him when we're up there. That it's incredible the stuff that we've been able to do. You know, it was a long trip getting out here.
No doubt.
It's incredible sometimes if you look back and think about the things that you've been able to do just to go play bluegrass. Mm-hmm. And
That's great. Well, that kind of leads me to, I know UConn is a big thing in your agenda, but what else you got going this summer? What are you looking forward to?
We're, as soon as we get back home, we get home Monday night, to Nashville, and then we'll drive back home, which that's about, from Nashville, where we live, is about, Keith's about 2.5-3 hours from Nashville.
Okay.
And, or Gary and I are probably about four and a half. And so we'll drive straight back home, and then we have to leave Wednesday morning and go out for the next weekend. We're playing in Indiana at the Bill Monroe Festival.
Yes.
In Blossom.
Yes, I was going to ask about that.
Leave from there and drive to Maine, and then we play on next Saturday in New York State. Then go back home and then go back out again. So the summer's busy. It's just, that's the way we like it.
Right.
It's the summer's, with any bluegrass band, summer's when you really are making your making your waves. You're
it's the festival circuit.
Yeah, you're outdoors. Okay. So we were talking about how hot it was here. We're in this warm streak here in UConn right now.
Yes.
But yeah, well, I was looking at the short range forecast for where we're playing in Indiana on Wednesday. It's supposed to be 95 Fahrenheit, and it's a hot festival.
95 and humid.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah. Right next to went to University of Indianapolis, so I kind of get that.
It's going to be one of those days. But it's festival season, and we look forward to it. And hopefully we'll start on another album, like Keith was saying. We're slowly gathering back up material, to start on a new album. So hopefully we'll get in at some point and hopefully have one out late this year, early next year.
Great.
Realistically.
Great.
And, that goes back to the folks at Mountain Home. They're real great about just if we want to take a year and a half, 2 years in between albums, there's no pressure.
They want it to be good.
Yeah. So they're just like, they let us go at our own rate. After the first album, they were kind of like, hey, you guys, you going to start on a new one sometime, And from that point, they just realized, we just kind of, we could throw together an album,
Right.
And we don't think, when we're making records, like, okay, this one needs to outdo the last one. This is going to be a landmark.
Okay.
I know people
that could be.
And it's like, man, if we did that, I would lose interest in making albums altogether.
Yes.
Because, if I start feeling pressure about, and I think, I don't speak for everybody here, but if I felt like a record company was doing that too, that would make me go, oh man, because I don't look at it that way.
Yeah.
It's like every album's just, every song's its own thing. And
to be fair, it's not impossible to produce and release your own stuff these days.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I mean, more and more, that's the case of people at home recording studios and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing about Mountain Home, and they've really never been involved in the production of the record. It's always been self-produced by the band as far as, what we do, the way we do the songs and
where we cut it.
Oh, I see. They don't hook you up with a producer?
No. I mean, we've talked about doing that at some point. I think it'd be something that would be really
cool to do.
But everything we've done so far has just been from the band.
Great.
Produced within the band. So it is good that they've let us do that. And that is probably the thing that I enjoy about it, is the fact that we can decide what we want to do.
Yes.
What songs we want to do, the kind of songs we want to do.
But recording is a pretty key part of this whole puzzle.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get another one, because we've got four out. Well, we've had the band together now 8 years, and this is our eighth year. And, we've got four projects out.
Right.
So, our average is every couple of years, getting one out. So it's time. It's time to do one. And no real theme to it or anything like that. It's just more whiskey, women, and death.
Heavy on the death.
We're looking at as many songs about bad tragedies as we can. So, it'll be our typical album for folks that know us.
Yeah.
But, that's where we all lean.
And then you will kind of road test some of these songs before you go in?
Some of them goes
both ways, I gather.
We've done it. Yeah, I think we may have done some songs like that before we recorded them. Mm-hmm. I can't really recall specifically. But a lot of times it's just like you described before, we'll kind of gather up some material and rehearse it and record it at the same time. We might record the whole record or track the whole record, and by the time we're done, I've forgotten, the first five or six songs that we've done.
Sure.
And then we just have to, learn them and kind of test them out on stage after the fact.
I see. Okay.
Sometimes we'll have something worked into the set. We've cut the album, but there's that span in between post-production and release.
Release, yes.
So that in that span, there's sometimes we've probably taken songs and sort of implemented them into the set. But generally, it's like, the album will be out, and it's like, man, that one's in this key, and it would work well after this song. So one of us has to go back and remember the words, and figure it out.
Okay.
That's me, because I'm the worst at words on the planet. But I have to sing them over and over and over and over and over and over.
Okay.
And, then if we don't do it for a couple shows, then I got to go back and do it again, because it's just gone.
Is that right?
I'm terrible with words. Keith can remember words. I can't.
Well, I sometimes forget the words of the songs that I've written. So.
That's a little embarrassing.
Not a lot, but I have forgotten.
Well, I suppose the more songs you write, the more likelihood that is going to happen. Well, I know that there are two subjects that are always avoided in polite company, but That being said, here in Canada, we seem mesmerized by your American political scene, especially with your new and controversial president. And it seems to us up here that folks in the States are really more polarized and divided than ever before. And I just wonder if you guys see this in your travels as a band.
No more than usual.
Okay.
And okay. From my viewpoint, I mean, people are always, they try to, I tell this to my students at school, you can make the business of music a lot harder than it is.
Yes.
And you can make the business of life a lot harder than it is.
Okay.
And you can make one man's opinion, hold a lot more weight than it really does.
Okay.
This is my personal belief. I'm speaking on the record, off the band record.
Right.
But I feel totally like the Lord's in control of all that. He's going to raise nations up. He's going to take nations down. Anybody gets too big for their britches, that's all going to, it's taken care of.
Okay.
And I don't worry about it.
Okay.
And it has nothing after, we've never consciously as a band tried to be political.
Okay.
Or apolitical.
Okay.
Or non-political. Or,
right.
You know, whatever. We don't campaign for anybody or whatever. And there's different opinions within the group, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason why we don't, you know, try to make any political posts as far as from the band's point of view, or at least not anymore. The fact that you're going to, if you think about it this way, it's probably not this way in bluegrass, but you know, you're going to make some of your fans mad, and you know, some of them may agree with you, but some of them are not going to agree with
okay.
you. So it's an area I think it's best, you know, for us to stay away from, because unlike, you know, sometimes entertainers latch on to things, you know, and try to use their status to sort of put forth some sort of issue. But they're, in my mind, their opinion matters no more than any one citizen.
Okay,
so
even though they have all this celebrity. And
right.
Okay.
And I feel the same way with, you know, we play bluegrass in a bluegrass band and, you know, try to go and entertain people. That's all we're designed to do.
Yeah.
Well, kind of my subset of this music or of this question is, do you think that music and bluegrass in particular can kind of help bring people together?
I think music does that, yeah. I think it can.
Sure, yeah. And I think, you know, if you get into that, like as a bluegrass band, and you start, and this is a small, like, well, it's that word that it's just a small sort of a boutique music, and you start getting real political or any direction you want to lean that's going to rub people the wrong way, you potentially alienate 50% of your audience, give or take.
Which is not helpful
in
the long run.
And that's not going to help you at all.
Right.
You know, it's like, I'm here to play mandolin.
Okay.
I'm not here to get on stage at the Kluane Mountain Bluegrass Festival and start talking trash about Donald Trump, James Comey, Hillary. We were talking about that this morning, how, you know, you pull up, and I'm like, I'm so tired of hearing about Comey and this and that, but I would be equally as tired if I'm hearing about, you know, Hillary Clinton versus this one, or
okay.
if Hillary had won, or
okay.
if this or that. And so that's not why I'm up here.
Okay.
I'm up here to entertain people, to play our music. We're tickled that we're here to do it, and I feel that way anywhere we play,
okay.
because people have asked us to come and play. And I'm not a political genius, and most people that you see on social media or otherwise, you know, going nutso about politics, it's just like what Keith said. I don't care if you're a political advisor for Donald Trump and you're sitting on the right hand on Air Force One right now, your opinion doesn't mean any more than your opinion means than his and mine.
Okay.
They may be smarter in a lot of areas as far as that's concerned, certainly,
sure.
but their vote, ideally, is not supposed to mean any more than mine.
Right.
So you vote your conscience, do your thing, and it's all going to happen like it's supposed to.
And to me, part of what music is about is getting away from all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's
worrying about death and
yeah.
murder.
All the good things.
That's stuff everybody's going to have to deal with. You know, it's
isn't
like
it
you're headed that way.
You're not going to get out of this one.
And it's like they could happen this second. I might breathe my last before I walk out of this schoolhouse. Or, you know, I might live to be 100. Five. I mean, who knows? Whatever. Well, if you live to 150, or anyway, it's, you know, if I live to be the oldest man on the planet, what, you know, that's awesome. But it's just, you know, that's a pet peeve of mine, and I'm gonna shut up. But I mean, some people that use their star power like there's such a thing in bluegrass, but you know, people that use that as a platform just to roll on things like that.
Right.
And that's all I'm saying. That's my soapbox, I guess. But it just, we've talked about it as a band, and it's you know.
Well, part of why I ask is even on our news, this is all the big stories, you know. It's not even happening in our country.
Right.
Yet.
And it seems that way globally.
Okay, it does.
You know, and certainly everywhere we go, you know, you drive through towns and, you know, you hear people talking and you look at newspapers and stores or at a truck stop or somewhere, and it's so...
Well, I think everybody's inundated with the 24-hour news cycle.
Well, and so isn't that right?
And that's created a lot of this perceived panic, you know, regardless of which way the pendulum swings politically, say in the United States or in Canada. But it's really, I don't think, ever as bad as anybody's making it out to be. I mean, there may
that's
be...
That's a good way to look at it.
There's different characters, certainly.
Yes.
But, you know, there were people thinking, you know, eight years ago that the world was coming to an end in the United States because they didn't like the president. So
in the last year, I've read a bunch of books about the Civil War and Lincoln, and he was dealing with a lot of the same stuff in 1860. Yeah. You know what I mean?
The same thing. It's like when Obama was elected, oh, there were people back home.
This is the end.
That's it.
Yeah. Our guns are gone.
Yeah.
And so the thing I find it's interesting, I guess the older you get, the more you notice this, is that it doesn't seem to affect me that much personally, you know.
Your daily life.
My daily life,
right.
You know, what's happening. I mean, obviously there are big issues that can change things, but everything, especially in our country, moves so slow. I mean, they don't seem to really be able to do anything but just make headlines. That's...
Legislatively in Congress, of course, okay. I just kind of take a bit of a chance even mentioning that, but thank you. I appreciate your opinions on that. Now let's get to what can our audience expect from a boxcar show?
Well, hopefully a good time. It's no frills. I mean, we just kind of we laugh about it on stage, but I mean we just do a lot of murder and death songs and sad stuff, and that's because that's the songs we tend to lean towards. But we have fun, and I hope that people would have fun with us. We try to not, you know, it's not like a Broadway show or a Vegas thing where it's like, hey, everybody, you know. But you know, we literally have fun when we play.
Great.
You know, we smile, we play. You know, we don't just stare at the floor and you know whatever. But it's not a we don't get together and choreograph a set.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
We just put a list of songs together that we're comfortable, that work good, and you know.
I was going to say, you're trying to build some kind of arc through the evening.
And you try to build up, you know, and it comes down, and then they tell us you've got time for one more, and we do a last song, and that's it. It's nothing, you know, but hopefully, and it's done us well this far. Trying to think of a way to put that, but that's the way we've always done it. We've never really put a lot of thought behind it.
If it ain't broke, right?
We just play.
Yeah.
And that's all we're here to do, is play, and play as best as we can, sing as best as we can. Some days are better than others. I think it's like ball players, you know. Some days ball players can go out and have like a magical thing, and it's like, oh man, I just...
Four home runs in one game comes to mind.
I had three home runs in one inning. Grand slam. You know, there's those days, and then there's days where it's like, man, have I ever played the mandolin before in my life?
Right.
You know, how do I hold a pig? But even on those days, you gotta get up, do it, just deal with it. That's, like I said, warts and all. You do it, and some days you can pull it off a whole lot better than others, but there's no rhyme or reason to that. It could be what you had for lunch. It could be something going on at home. It could
be
anything. So we're here to play, and hopefully wherever we're at, that people may see us, whether it's here in Canada or in the Yukon or in the States or anywhere we're playing, you know, they'd have a good time. That's all we can ask, and we just do what we do and play the songs that we play, and it's not reinventing the wheel, it's just playing bluegrass.
Well, all I can say about that is it seems to be working.
We enjoy it. We literally enjoy it. So it's
that comes across very well. Well, thanks so much for speaking to me today, you guys. I really appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Glad to. Thank you. Thank you. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to a conversation between Steve Gedrose and the five members of the Boxcars from Tennessee. Now we invite you to listen to their music, which you will find in Jam Live, Episode 70, on our website, junctionjam.ca. Just click the Jam Live link. A heap of thanks to the Yukon Bluegrass Music Society for all their support, and to Steve Gedrose for preparing and conducting the interview. This show was happily brought to you by Junction Arts and Music, written and produced by Dieter Gade, and I am Maria Leniak.